And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You already know that global warming is real, that changes are happening, and that everyone is beginning to know we have to do something about it. But what? The age of regulation, administration, and fines is just not going to work on a global basis. But innovation just may. And the strategy to ignite real innovation around the world is referred to as cap and trade. What is it? And what's it mean to you? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
In the nation's capital, at a Senate hearing on climate change, the chairman and CEO of Pacific Gas and Electric, Peter A. Darby, opened his testimony with this.
On behalf of PG&E Corporation and the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, or U.S. CAP, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. PG&E is California's largest energy provider. Our company is also one of the nation's cleanest utilities, and we're an acknowledged leader in energy efficiency. U.S. CAP is a unique alliance of leading companies from diverse sectors of the economy and major environmental organizations. Our organization is here because we share a view that climate change is the most pressing environmental issue of our time, and also because we agree that as the world's largest source of global warming emissions, our country has an obligation to lead. No other country matches the U.S. in terms of our capital resources and its capacity for innovation. Our economy is the world's locomotive, and U.S. CAP believes it is critical to get that engine pulling in the right direction on climate change. Toward that end, we've outlined an aggressive but entirely achievable set of public policy principles and a legislative framework. This morning, I'll talk about three areas in particular: improving energy efficiency, developing a smart grid for electricity, and making smart decisions about the diversity of the fuels we use to generate electricity. Keep in mind, the backdrop is our recommendation favoring a program that creates a long-term price signal for carbon by creating a mandatory cap on greenhouse gas emissions, combined with a trading program that uses the market to establish that long-term price signal and lets companies figure out how best to meet the goals. I personally believe we are going to meet the challenges we're talking about today. But as I've said, I'm also a realist, and I recognize that doing so will be tough. We're going to need your continued support and leadership. On behalf of PG&E and U.S. CAP, thank you for the opportunity to be part of a serious discussion on this very serious issue. We look forward to working with you going forward.
Along with Mr. Darby were the CEOs from both British Petroleum and DuPont. And they were of one mind about global warming, climate change, and the pressing need to act. When players at this level commit, we can know that change is coming, and the change that you'll be hearing a lot about will be carbon cap and trade. In a nutshell, it says that a company in one part of the world, Los Angeles for example, will be able to purchase carbon credits from a company which produces cleaner energy in Minnesota or Arizona, and thus offset their carbon footprint, which may exceed the limits or caps imposed by regional, state, and some would hope, national and eventually international regulations. This week, leaders from around the world gathered at the United Nations to address the consequences of a carbon-based global economy. They met to move forward towards a global effort to reduce the CO2 that is generating global warming. Here's the reality they define. A global carbon cap and trade system is emerging. It will affect us all. But what is a carbon cap and trade system? Today, as world leaders forge a vision of this new multi-billion dollar trading system, we take the time to go in depth to help you understand carbon cap and trade. And although I know this may not seem as interesting as, say, animal emotions, in fact, it nevertheless may have direct impact on the future of the natural world and the living systems we care about. So take the time to listen. I'm confident that when you've finished listening to today's show, you'll know more about carbon cap and trade than 99% of the rest of the world. It's an insider's look at this new global market. It's a very complex and confusing concept for many to grasp, which some say will become one of the hottest markets in years to come, shuffling and investing hundreds of billions of dollars ultimately to drive the greenhouse gases from the environment and hopefully turn the specter of global warming around. Today, we go in-depth in segments 1 and 2 with the managing director of Cantor Fitzgerald, who discusses the challenges all the way from the emerging local to the future global strategies. I know you'll find this discussion extremely useful in understanding this complex issue. In segment 3, we head up to Portland, Oregon, where we talk with the executive director of the Carbon Trust, which has been active in the cap and trade arena for 10 years. Oregon is way ahead of others in implementing their legal and administrative system, and cap and trade is alive and well and making history that others are watching carefully. So without further fanfare, let's find out what carbon cap and trade is going to mean in your life and the lives of your children and your children's children and your children's children's children and your children's children's children. I'm going to be up in San Francisco. San Francisco is always a wonderful city to visit. And I'm going up there because there is going to be a conference that's dealing with this issue of CO2 cap and trade. The global CO2 cap and trade movement really is what it is. And to help us understand the CO2 cap and trade, and as well to talk about what this means on a personal, business, and national, international, and global level, is the managing director of Cantor Fitzgerald, Josh Margolis. Josh, I want to welcome you to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a huge topic, carbon cap and trade. Very difficult for me to understand, for others to understand, and we're going to try to get into that such that the average person can get a better grasp of why this is important and what it really means and what they can do. They can play in this game from any number of different levels. But first of all, I'd like to get a little background about yourself and how it is that you're involved in what we might call the Wall Street world of finance and brokerage and trading and, in essence, sort of commodity trading, a new form of commodities. Is there something beyond that that has brought you to become focused in this particular area? Some people are just in it for the money, okay? Most people that think about investments and Wall Street and commodity trading and things, think about people who are in it for the money. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with making money. And that's something that we have to learn as environmentalists, but there's all sorts of ways to make money. And I'm curious if it's just money or if there's something else that brought you to this point.
What brought me here was my dad. He set me out on a path in the first Earth Day in 1970. And I distinctly remember walking down the street on a country road in New Hampshire, picking up trash and talking with my dad about the social responsibility that we have with our good fortune to be in the position we are, the society that we're in, with the opportunities we have comes a responsibility to give back. He was the sort of fellow who didn't ask why me. He said, why not me? That was the first step. I then ended up learning how to scuba dive at an early age. Worked briefly for EPA as an intern. Thought that's where I was going to go in order to affect social change in the environment. Ended up working for a private industry. First in the consulting firm in order to, my job was to assess environmental compliance and at industrial facilities and also look for ways that they could better comply and turn their waste streams into profit streams. Then I got into the emissions trading world back in the mid-80s, working for a company that was the first emissions trading specialty firm, and then joined eventually Cantor Fitzgerald in October of 1995.
It's obvious that this is something that's very close to your heart and that you take this all very seriously, that you care about the earth. Now you're working in this concept of carbon credits and trading. You've mentioned that you got started in 1988. Was this with the sulfur trading?
No, actually, in the mid-80s, the focus was on new source review offsets. The law was pretty straightforward. It served as a break on the economy. The law said that in areas of the country where the air was not good, was failed to attain the standards established by Congress. These are health-based standards. That you couldn't expand a refinery, a manufacturing operation. So if you were in Los Angeles or Houston or New Jersey or San Francisco, the San Joaquin Valley, and the air was bad, and you went to get a permit to put on a new line, new tanks, et cetera, the regulators would say, sorry, you can't do that because you're going to make the air quality worse. Until somebody said, you know what, I think we have a way that we can accommodate both environmental improvements as well as growing the economy. Let's let this guy have a permit to expand his refinery so long as he accomplishes a reduction somewhere else in the airshed. This was the idea of new source review offsets. So if you pay somebody else to accomplish a reduction that's beyond that which is required by law, that's quantifiable, that's enforceable, that's surplus, then you can take a portion of those emission reductions and use them at your new refinery. And this idea of new source review offsets has been around since the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
The S-RAIN program came about in 1990 as a result of the first President Bush. He was enamored with the idea of using the market to accomplish environmental change and to allowing for economic growth. And it's actually one of the most successful programs that that we've seen so far.
It has been a struggle between forces that would say that somehow the government should really step in and take measures to regulate versus a free market economy where somehow we're able to, rather than regulate and have people come in and enforce and fine, there may be a different power, which has to do with the power of the purse, and that if things become too costly, then some will find an alternative.
I think you put your finger on a good part of it. This idea of emissions trading, the idea of a cap-and-trade program, allows the government to do what it does best and the industry to do what it does best. The government is very good at establishing the standards, defining what's safe and what's not safe,
mm-hmm.
at enforcing against those who don't comply, at assessing compliance and at enforcing against those who don't comply, at penalizing those who don't comply. They're not so good at figuring out the best way to produce a product, to manufacture a widget, and in fact, they're not the best at figuring out how to reduce emissions. They aren't there on site. They don't know the processes like the manufacturing operators do. The manufacturers, on the other hand, they're motivated by, absent any other corporate goals, by producing a product that's better than anybody else's. And reducing the impact of that product on the bottom line. If they see that there's a cost to producing a product with significant emissions, they're going to look at a way, they're going to try to figure out how to reduce those emissions costs. They're going to look at a way, try to figure out how they can reduce the cost to the point where they turn the waste streams into profit streams. This idea of a cap-and-trade program is where you see the collision of some two very powerful ideas. Those who have a problem, and those are the manufacturers who are producing a product who have been given the mandate to reduce emissions, and those who have an idea. The idea is that they can compete with each other to reduce emissions in the most cost-effective way. And when you have this sort of competition, you have a number of different air quality entrepreneurs all competing with each other to come up with the best way to reduce emissions. And it's from this competition that you come up with these innovative, novel solutions that allow you to comply at levels that are far below that which the government could have mandated.
I think maybe where some people begin to wonder, how does this actually factor? You were, for example, talking about in Los Angeles, in an area where there's high pollution. So that really becomes almost like a city or a regional cap-and-trade system.
Sure. Mm-hmm. The government takes a look at the meteorology of the area, sees that it, you know, that you have a bowl of mountains within which the air quality acts and with some the air and the meteorology acts in some consistent ways, and you can pretty well predict what the air is going to do and how much pollution is going to be in the air at any given set of circumstances.
So the objective there is to really lower that, the amount of carbon dioxide, if we focus on carbon dioxide, in that specific area. So that becomes, in essence, a regional marketplace, an active regional marketplace where there can be limits placed and therefore the trading can exist within that zone.
Well, it's probably better to focus on not so much on CO2 in Los Angeles, because CO2 is really a global pollutant, and the scientists will tell us that a ton of reductions in Los Angeles are equal to a ton of reductions in bulk air.
Well, that's what I want to move out to, is how do we then get the larger perspective? And you're making exactly the right leap, okay? So for example, in L.A., if it was possible to regulate the amount of CO2, it would work, and it has worked in many cases. What's the next sort of chain of the process here in is setting these criteria for industry, giving out the credits, and then ultimately what you're involved in, and that is brokering these. But let's go up to the next level.
We go from the scientists. The scientists, they're the ones that we turn to and say, what's the carrying capacity of the atmosphere? How much can we absorb before we suffer the consequences? The scientists give us their best answers. The politicians then take over and they say, how do we come up with the best way to address this problem? And it's up to the politicians, frankly, to decide if there's a problem. If the scientists say that there's a problem and the politicians don't agree, then we're left with the politicians deciding that it's okay to have this level of pollution in the air.
Good point.
And if we don't, and if we have politicians that decide that and the people don't like it, then it's up to the people to affect a regime change, to look for new politicians. And it's interesting how now, for example, we have San Francisco values that are now in Washington, embodied by Barbara Boxer and Nancy Pelosi. And Governor Schwarzenegger has stepped up to the plate.
Absolutely,
said,
right.
The debate is over. We're not going to talk about whether or not there's a problem. We know there's a problem.
Right.
Trying to solve the problem.
Yep.
So how to solve the problem? We have a choice. We can tell people exactly what to do and how to do it and tell how to manufacture the products and what controls to use. Or we can give them a declining checkbook, an emissions cap.
Mm-hmm.
You're allowed to emit 1,000 tons this year, 900 tons next year, 800 tons the following year, all the way down to the point where you as an individual manufacturing operation, like your brethren, folks in the geographic area, have had to accomplish reductions. And with this declining checkbook, with the need to operate within this cap, you have made choices along the way. Do I reduce my emissions by shutting down? By curtailing operations? Well, hopefully not. Do I find new ways to produce my product in ways that are less intensive in terms of carbon and NOx and SOx and particulate matter? And should I do that myself, or should I pay somebody else to reduce their emissions? Well, I should probably pay somebody else to reduce their emissions if it costs them less than it costs me to do it on site. And that way, as on the aggregate level, the economy benefits. Everybody benefits. We get the biggest bang for the buck, the biggest reduction for the dollar.
Help me and listeners understand, how are those credits determined? That's what I'm trying to get a handle on. There's the national, there's state, there's regional. Give me a sense of where that's moving, how that's developing. Because this is a new economic science.
Well, most scientists, in fact, most politicians who believe that there's a global warming problem, believe that you look at the carrying capacity of the Earth with respect to CO2. It makes sense to figure out how much CO2 can be absorbed in the atmosphere, how much greenhouse gases can be absorbed in the atmosphere before we have too much, before we reach a tipping point, before we can't reverse the trend. The choice is to either look at the budget as the Earth's budget, or to look at it as the U.S. budget, or the India's budget, or China's budget. From starting from scratch, it makes sense to do it on the global level. But we have certain realities. The realities are that we have different countries which are autonomous. Folks have decided to participate in the Kyoto Treaty. Others have decided not to. Those who have decided to participate have decided that it makes sense to act in unison and to affect change amongst all of the Kyoto countries and invite others to participate. Those who have stood on the outside, such as Australia and the U.S., have decided that it's not appropriate to participate. So we have politicians who have decided where there's a problem and how best to solve it. Those politicians are also the ones who have decided how to allocate emission reductions, how to allocate the cap, how to allocate emission reduction responsibilities.
Okay, let's talk about the United States, because I understand the conflict here between where the U.S. is and compared with most of the rest of the world, and that's what I want to do, is really talk about the United States. So people understand how it is what they do, and how it is that the decisions that are made in their region, in their city, in their state, and in their nation, really do have a consequence, because it's a big world, it's a huge world. Let's try to develop this model. For example, we could say that there is a national level of carbon emissions that are accepted. That would be a national cap. But that may not happen for a while. So perhaps a state may say, well, in this state, this is the cap that we wish, because we want in on this. We think it's a good thing. Or if a state doesn't, then perhaps a city might decide that they also want to regulate. Where is that? Where do we sit in that process of determining those caps? Because I think it's quite varied.
There are, you're right, Sidney. There are, last count, I think 12 different bills sitting in Congress aimed at global warming, at reducing, at developing a national program. And most all politicians in the state levels, in the regional levels, the local levels, believe that if you're going to solve this problem, you should develop a program on the national level. The problem is that if you wait for the national government to do something, if you wait for President Bush to change his mind, if you wait for him to decide that we should accomplish emission reductions by using a cap and trade program, you're going to find yourselves waiting for the perfect. In this case, the perfect solution is a national solution, and the perfect is the enemy of the good. And the good enough is what we're seeing emerge from the bottom up, where we don't have a top-down program coming from Washington. We have a bottom-up program emerging from the states.
That's precisely the point I'm trying to make, that we're starting at the ground level here and trying to make some, we're developing this market because it is not coming from the top.
It's the market that's the solution from the top is one that many folks in California have decided, in the regional greenhouse gas initiative in the Northeast states. In other states, have decided is not good enough, is not fast enough, is not aggressive enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you see folks in California, in Sacramento, in Albany, in the Northeast who said we're gonna solve this problem ourselves. It's not ideal for us to do it all by ourselves, but if we're successful, we're going to make a difference both in California and the Northeast, and perhaps we establish a wave that washes throughout the country. In that way, you're not waiting for something that may never come from Washington.
You got to start somewhere.
You have to start somewhere, and if you talk to the folks in Sacramento, and Governor Schwarzenegger, who's undertaken a pretty aggressive goal, which is to reduce emissions by upwards of 30% by the year 2020, that is a tremendously aggressive goal. It's a goal that will change the economy in California, that will affect every single individual in the state of California in ways that can't be, at this point, ascertained. But it's also a goal that is not the end point. It's not where the governor wants to go. If we only cause change in California, the program will not be a success. The program will only be a success if you look at other states who have signed on. Other localities, other regional government entities have signed on that have decided that they want to participate as well and that they have signed on to the same goals. And California then will have acted as a catalyst.
That's exactly correct. But now I also want to say, now let's talk about implementing in California, because I really want to get a handle on how this will emerge. It's time to bring this on home, and we do, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Well, we can keep our eyes upon the skies and see how the time goes by. Or we can find our fears among the tears that will fall when the meadows cry, cry, cry.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
We hear about global warming every single day. And warming is not warm and fuzzy. Where's the David to slay the global Goliath? Many are pointing to a cap-and-trade marketplace. What's that going to look like? And how's it all work? We continue to explore the many facets of the global CO2 cap-and-trade future when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. We continue now to deepen our understanding of carbon cap and trade. We're talking with Josh Margolis, who's the managing director of Cantor Fitzgerald. And Josh, we need to be able to visualize how this works. And we've talked about the fact that, for example, California now, Governor Schwarzenegger has really made a commitment to deal with greenhouse gas levels and setting up systems to deal with this, and primarily with carbon caps and enforcement. Now I want to figure out, and I'm sure you can help us out here, how do we see this happening? In other words, so the state has made this decision. Who participates? Are they able to, for example, to say, well, we're going to assign these credits to industries, to sectors, to corporations, to specific corporations, to those people who would be the major contributors to conceivably carbon dioxide in our environment? Let's start with that. Do you have a concept on how that's done, how that may be done in California, for example?
The world in 7 days. I mean, those are excellent questions. The governor did both the hard and the easy thing. He said the debate is over. We have a problem. We're going to fix it, and we're going to reduce our emissions by 200 million tons by the year 2020. And then he had an executive order that says beyond that, we're going to reduce our emissions by a total of 90% by the year 2050. So that's a very hard thing to say because it takes a leap of faith. But it's also, the guy who's got the most difficult job is Chuck Schulock at the California Resources Board. He's the one that's tasked with managing a process that's going to define who's in the program, whether it's a command and control or a market-based program, which sectors are in the program, when the reductions have to begin, whether or not there are annual reduction requirements or whether it's just one grand reduction requirement by the year 2020, what the enforcement consequences are, whether or not reductions from other states can be used. There are a host of issues, whether it's an upstream or a downstream program.
It's no wonder I'm having a difficult time, as well as everybody else, understanding this.
The folks who understand how significant this program is, will be to California are the ones who understand that it's going to affect them, their businesses, their competition. Folks in every sector of the economy are going to be affected by this program in ways that they can't fathom or imagine at this point. They will be going through a conversion, and it's up to the folks in Sacramento and the business in the Chamber of Commerce and the trade associations to proselytize and to help them understand that it's a new world. The guys on the beach who are looking at the wave coming in, who see the ripple, you know, some of them understand that it's a tsunami that is going to wash through the economy. Some of them are taking pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are saying it can't have much of an effect because it's not so big right now. Some of them are lying down in the sun. Others have started to run, and others are going for high ground, and they're trying to figure out what their opportunities are, and they're taking steps now.
Mm-hmm.
The folks who are going to win are the ones who understand how significant this program is, what's at stake, and what decisions have to be made. The ones who win will be the ones who participate in the policy-making process, who advocate whether or not to auction or allocate emissions, whether or not it's going to be a command and control program or a permit or a market-based program.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who participate in these discussions, who make their voices heard, will have their voices heard in the policy-making debates, and that those policy-making debates are ongoing right now.
I'm looking at some models. I'd like to envision some models. One could be, for example, if this was my job, I might say, well, let's start somewhere. One of the corporate sectors that we can really focus on are energy companies, because they add a lot directly. We can see it coming out of their smokestacks all over California. And there's a lot of them. There's a whole lot of them, and they're adding a lot to our greenhouse gases. What if we started with them? I'm just trying to get a sense of how this might develop.
Well, you could limit the program just to the power sector.
Right, you could. You could say that's where we're going to start.
Mm-hmm. But okay. If you did that, you'd be missing most of the problem. Most of the problem comes from the transportation sector.
Well, this is where we get into these. And then how in the world would you begin to, we'll brainstorm here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you. But hey, I got a car. How am I going to play in this game? Or how are these regulations going to affect me? Let's just talk about that. Tell me what your thoughts are.
Well, if I'm a policymaker, I want to affect change. I want people's behavior to change. I want them to use less fuel, to drive fewer miles, to make changes in their lives that will reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases. I can do that by tapping into their own incentives that they respond to. I can make gasoline more expensive. I can put on congestion use charges on toll roads, on highways. I can make it expensive to park at work. I can reward people for taking steps that reduce the vehicle miles traveled, both in terms of reducing fees and costs, and I can provide them with free parking, right? Or I can go upstream. I can affect the people who sell the fuels, who run the toll roads, who distribute the fuels in pipelines. I can go all the way up to the people who bring in the fuels across state borders, and I can to levy a fee or a tax of sorts on what they do and the products that they sell in the state. Now, taxes in California, you may have heard, are not very popular. And a politician doesn't stand much of a chance if he advocates, frankly, a carbon tax. So what do you do?
Yeah.
You can mandate specific control measures, or you can offer people a declining emissions budget. You can say, you can operate in the state of California, you can live in the state of California, you can use fuels, you can distribute fuels so long as you stay within the emissions allocation that I'm giving you.
In essence, that would put a real limit in terms of how much a person could participate in the game, how much they could sell, for example, once they reach that. Am I right about that? That it might put a limit on what they can market, how much they can market.
Yeah, I mean, every activity has a carbon footprint. And the smart policymaker is going to figure out a way to incentivize folks to reduce that, the size of the carbon footprint, and disincentivize the folks who take no steps to reduce it, in fact, folks who put more carbon into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly a limit on you if you do nothing. If you do nothing to change your footprint, if you do nothing to change the carbon intensity of your manufacturing operations.
Good point, yeah.
It's certainly the limit. But it is no limit for those who can figure out how to operate within their carbon budget, and people have expanded gloriously in other cap-and-trade programs.
That becomes the aha, that's the incentive. Okay, if I want to expand the capacity for me to market a particular product because of the caps, what I need to do now is to figure out ways to reduce that footprint, and then I can sell more.
Reduce the footprint, and so you can sell more chairs, gasoline, houses, cars, glass windows. Any product that's made in the state of California mm-hmm. has a carbon footprint. The manufacturer, the distributor, the reseller will likely be drawn into this program. Will be provided an opportunity to participate in this cap and trade program, if in fact that's the way it goes.
Well, now, from my perspective, this would be to some extent an administrative nightmare, in the sense that thousands and thousands of people are going to have to go around and literally make determinations about what that carbon footprint is. How is that handled? How's that going to? What are people talking about in terms of how that would actually happen?
Well, it could be a nightmare, or it could be very elegantly simple.
Oh, there we go.
Your challenge as a policymaker is to figure out why people do things. They do things because they have an opportunity to make money, to save money, to provide for the security of their family, to meet the mandates of the corporate CEO. So all you need to do is to figure out why people do things and how to torque the programs in order to accomplish those ends. Now, of course, there are many, many different ways to verify and to determine whether or not the goals are being met. But at the end of the day, you as an individual, as a corporation, as a trade association, will have a declining emissions checkbook. You're going to be responsible for reporting what your emissions are. And either you're going to be compliant because you've kept your emissions within that allocation, or you won't. And if you're not, you're going to suffer the consequence. Who's included in the trading program? That's up to the policymakers. Will you be included as an individual? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Will your school be included? There's a good chance it will.
Mm-hmm.
Will it be the school district? It's a good chance. Will it be the school bus, the folks who manufacture and sell the school buses? There's a good chance.
You know, the model that we're really talking about very often are what are referred to as carbon credits. In other words, that various businesses, designation is, will receive so many credits that they can then begin to exchange. The good guys can sell theirs to the bad guys, so to speak. And in that process, be rewarded for having a smaller footprint. But now I want to talk about
Let me interrupt you there.
Yeah,
not
sure.
So much the good guys and the bad guys. It's the guys who have an opportunity to reduce their emissions at a lower cost. Those are the ones that should attract the capital.
Mm-hmm.
Why should I spend $10 to accomplish a pound of carbon reductions when I can do it for $1?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And is the guy for whom it's going to cost $10 a bad guy? No, he's not a bad guy. He's the one that is faced with a compliance control cost curve that's far steeper than somebody else. And we as a society, we should want the most efficient use of our money.
Mm-hmm.
We should spend only the minimum amount of money to come up with the needed reductions and use the rest of the money for other needs.
One of the things that I hear people talking about, and I've been approached in different situations, is that I, as an individual, in an almost an act of consciousness, but it does have real consequence, can in essence, we're almost having to become a little bit politically correct here, but that I can literally buy off my guilt. I as a household, I have a house, I have a car, I've got a couple of cars here. I try to be efficient, and I'm also concerned that I can actually participate in buying credits and therefore, in essence, eliminate my carbon footprint from this concept of the limits, the cap, okay? Can you help people understand that concept, because people are talking about that?
Sure. And it's, I guess I go back to the first Earth Day when I was walking down the street picking up trash. I didn't do that out of guilt. I did that following my father's example as a way to do what was the responsible thing to do, to take care of my own footprints, to take care of my own society, to offset my own impact and that of my neighbors. That's a responsible thing to do. And customers who buy products, whether it's an airline seat or a hotel room or a car, or who buy power from the grid, they look at this global warming problem, and oftentimes they're paralyzed by it. You know, they know, they have a sense that it's real. They have a sense that it needs to be addressed. They have a sense that the consequence of not addressing it is pretty significant. But what can they do as an individual? How can they affect change? Well, it's up to the corporate world who sells products to these individuals. It's up to the folks who sell the airline seats, to sell the cars, the hotel rooms, the opportunities to park in a garage. It's up to them to figure out how an individual can participate. Well, one way to do it is to calculate what the impact is of parking in a garage, of buying a car, of driving into the city, of driving to the mountains, of skiing in Squaw Creek. To calculate the cost of doing that, both in terms of carbon as well as the cost of reducing that carbon emissions, and saying to me, the consumer, would you like to participate in solving the problem? Well, sure I would. Nobody's ever offered me the chance to do that before. How much will it cost, by the way? Oh, you know, for this particular flight across country, it'll cost you $6 to offset your carbon footprint. $6? That's not so bad. I just spent $650 to fly across country to a round trip. Add another $6 to it? I can do that. Yeah, would that make me feel good? Sure it would, because I'm doing the right thing.
Now, the question that I think a lot of people would ask at a certain point is, and I think rightfully so, because this is just the way the brain works, you know. Wait a second, I just gave somebody $6. What did I give them $6 for? What are they going to do with that $6, and how is that going to somehow end up solving the problem?
Excellent question. The power is not in your individual action, but you're everybody else on that plane, everybody else who's in on the sixth floor of the Sheraton Hotel that you're staying in, just like everybody else who's driving across the Golden Gate Bridge or who's skiing that day in Squaw Creek. Those who have decided to participate, they're also contributing $6. That $6 times 1,000 people can turn into $6,000, which can then buy a good quantity of carbon reductions once aggregated together. So the power is in the numbers, the folks who are of like minds, who individually act in a collective way, whose monies and resources then can be targeted towards projects, carbon reduction projects aimed at schools, changing out light bulbs, carbon reduction projects aimed at changing out old hot water heaters, making them more efficient, changing out school buses to make them use less fuel, changing out the power loss associated with industrial boilers.
I follow your thinking here. The 1,000 people who paid the $6 to, we'll say it's a company, that there was a company that was able to market to 1,000 people a $6 carbon credit.
Let's go back there. It's not sure. $6 per credit. It's $6 to accomplish, to buy off the reductions, to pay for sufficient reductions to offset your footprint.
What does that company, okay, then let's go to that company that now has the money. How do they then play in the marketplace such that it ultimately ends up in something real?
Well, those monies go to specific projects, whether it's in the community or in a neighboring community or somewhere else in the state of California or in the Kalahari Desert where they're using solar ovens as opposed to burning biomass fuel.
So would this be in the form of investment?
It's money that's then turned around and plowed back into projects that need the money in order to accomplish greenhouse gas reductions on-site locally where those projects
are. And I'm really just trying to understand this. Would this be in the form of a grant or a gift? There's kind of three ways to do it. A grant, a loan, or investment. Which one, where are we going with those in terms of how that money that they would have would then become distributed to these projects?
Yes. It's used in all three ways and other ways. It's up to the market to come up with the most cost-effective solution. Remember, behind the scenes, we have a bunch of air quality entrepreneurs. They're all competing with each other to use those monies to come up with cost-effective, quality ways of reducing carbon. And it's the ones who have the best solutions, the most cost-effective solutions, the ones that are going to deliver the best carbon that will win those monies. And is it somebody who's deciding? Is it a commission or a foundation that decides who gets the monies? In the long run, it's the market that decides it. It's the forces of supply and demand.
Well, that's very interesting. So it really is a free-form market. I guess the thing that I think some people get confused about, and I realize, actually, quite honestly, what we're talking about here is many different visions of how this will happen. So there is no one answer. No one can be expected to have one answer to this.
There are some in Sacramento and in Washington who believe they do have the answer, and they're going to do their level best to have their answer be that which emerges from the other end of the policymaking black box.
Right, but until such time, then it's much more on an individual basis and on a smaller scale.
Right now, there is no mandate.
Right.
In California, we don't have a mandate to offset your carbon when you go skiing, to when you drive your car, when you stay in a hotel, when you take a flight. There is no mandate.
Mm-hmm.
The mandates will be emerging from a policymaking process, and a program will commence starting sometime before 2012.
Now I want to focus this in one little area. Let's say, for example, now that we've moved along and the state has decided to focus on just power companies. Let's just say it was that. Okay, because this will help people understand how this could work. So they've decided that power companies contribute so much to greenhouse gases, and they've decided now to distribute credits, a certain number of credits to each power company per, let's say, 1,000 megawatts of production. You get so many credits. Now, one company is a cleaner company, and the carbon footprint that they put out is much less than another company that perhaps is using coal or some other less clean source of energy. In order for them to comply, they're going to have to buy some credits from a cleaner company. That's where this market happens. Any concept of how those companies, one company that perhaps is green, perhaps they're a solar company, and they therefore have credits that they can sell, and then there's another company that's old coal and polluting, and they need to buy these credits. Let's talk about that exchange. How do they talk to each other? How do they do business? How do they exchange those credits?
Well, in the state of California, actually, if you're generating power, you're required now to generate power as if you're using the cleanest fuels available. If you're importing power from out of the state, you have to apply the same standard. So already these folks are faced with a need under SB 1368, the Parada bill, to generate power using clean fuels. They're also required to they're subject to a renewable portfolio standard where they have to have a certain percentage of the power generated from renewable energy, which is generally thought of as having a lower greenhouse gas footprint than through fossil fuels. But let's assume that beyond that, that I'm allocated, or I'm given 10,000 tons of carbon allowances, and my business as usual strategy requires me to put out 15,000 tons.
Right.
So I've got a 5,000 ton deficit. What do I do? I've got a couple of choices. I don't have to buy from you. I can solve my problems myself. It's within my power to generate enough electricity to serve my customers and to stay within my 10,000 ton limit. How can I do that? Well, I can do that by changing the fuel mix, by buying more renewables, by generating more power from renewables, which has the effect of generating more power in a way that produces less carbon. I can switch. I can buy power from somebody else and stop generating myself. And that if I generate power through the use of natural gas, and I can stop doing that for one unit, and I can buy solar generated power from somebody else, and I can support their project, right? Or I can buy allowances from somebody else, carbon allowances, and those carbon allowances I can buy from another utility or somebody else who has decided that they wanted to participate in that market. And whether it's a utility-only market or a multi-sectoral market, I should have expect to see folks who have permits and carbon-generating activities in the state, as well as who are participants and who are speculators who provide liquidity to the market.
But those credits, therefore, have a certain value, and that value is fluctuating. It is a market. It's like a commodity. Am I correct about that?
Sure.
It becomes a market.
The value does fluctuate, yes.
Right, exactly. And so, for example, a person could an individual buy some of those credits, for example?
Sure, mm-hmm. An individual could buy it. An environmental group could buy it. A school district could buy it. The third grade class could buy it. A foundation could buy it. The California Pension Trust could buy it. A Wall Street company could buy it. Mm-hmm. Anybody could participate.
People can actually participate in those exchanges and actually affect what's happening in terms of this dynamic between some of these big power companies.
And that's the beauty of what California is doing. California has said we're going to, without regard to what Washington is doing, this is the program. It's going to affect California industries. Now, we have the ability to affect change elsewhere. How do we do that? Well, we can do that by allowing in emission reductions, the offsets, if you will, that are generated in Nevada or Rhode Island or Uganda or some other geographic area outside of California, mm-hmm. so long as they meet our criteria.
Mm-hmm.
So California can say, okay, you can accomplish a reduction in New Jersey, but it has to be according to our criteria. So they have control now. They have effective control over emissions-generating activities that are going on across the country. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Isn't that a good thing?
Well, it's so interesting because this ultimately leads to what, for example, Kyoto was trying to accomplish, and that is a global market, a global cap, a global means to regulate and therefore control and diminish the pollutants in our air, the greenhouse gases. So it's beginning. It's actually beginning.
It's beginning, and it's driven first by the people who are work for CEOs or light CEOs who, are, for whatever reason, have decided that it's time to change their formula to reduce the emissions of carbon. And they may be doing it because of an altruistic need, because it's a grandfather looking out for his grandchildren, because it's a CEO who is expecting to see carbon control requirements on the horizon, who's been told by his insurance carrier that he's got to reduce his exposure to the carbon related events that could come about associated with future weather, and what can he do individually to affect those events, or because shareholders are expected to voice their concerns about how the company is managing its carbon footprint, and with the understanding that if they fail to manage it appropriately, if they don't manage it, that the shareholders will then suffer. Or it's coming about as a result of the state of California, who said that you will be expected to participate in a carbon control program.
I think this would be the thought pattern for quite a number of people that I'm aware of, where they might say something like this. They might say, well, okay, great. So we're supposed to do this, but some little country in Africa or perhaps some burg of Russia that doesn't want to play in this game could pollute, not play in the game, and screw it all up, and it's all kind of a meaningless effort, because if they're not part of this economic cap system, they kind of mess up the game, don't they?
Well, you I guess it's you're left at the end of the day with your own decisions that you need to make. And you can make those decisions because you believe they're right, or you can make the decisions based upon what you think you can get away with. And if you're able to walk away from a mess that you've made and say, I'm not going to clean it up until somebody else cleans up their mess overseas, then are you really doing the responsible thing? If you know that failing to address the problem today is going to exacerbate the problem, so that when ultimately you're forced to address it in the future, when the world has finally got a consensus, that the cost have been passed on down to future generations, and that your children's children are going to both suffer the consequences of your inactivity as well as the cost of addressing it because you've delayed it, do you really feel good about that? It gets back to what my dad said. Why not me? Why shouldn't I act?
Josh Margolis, I want to just say, I got a great big smile on my face. It is so refreshing to hear someone from the what we would call the corporate and finance world talking with such a high sense of idealism. Because I'm asking some tough questions, and you're really coming back to some very profound guidance. It's up to each of us now to take a stand to do the right thing.
It's up to each of us, but also to demand that the others in our community, the folks that we buy products from, to give us an opportunity to participate.
Mm-hmm.
I want to buy your product. I'd like to keep on buying it. I like what you do. Let me participate. Let me make a difference. Because I will. If you let me, I will.
Help me help you help everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. Thank you so much, Josh. First of all, it has really helped me to understand, and I'm sure many other people, about the carbon cap and trade system. Josh Margolis, Managing Director of Cantor Fitzgerald, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. It was a pleasure.
That's a broad and open-ended discussion of the cap and trade future. Next, we go where the future is now, to Oregon, where a cap and trade system is up and running. Stay tuned.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
So has anyone actually set up a cap-and-trade system? Yes. Okay, so what's it look like? And how much money is involved? And can I play in this multi-billion dollar arena? This and many other questions about cap-and-trade will be cleared up when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Stay tuned. Our in-depth exploration of the world of carbon cap and trade now moves on up to Oregon, where a progressive commitment to action through legislative mandate has been making history, and the whole world is watching. Global warming is with us pretty much the whole world now, except for a few individuals. have pretty much acknowledged that we face, in this particular century, a lot of challenges, and we're all really aware of that, listeners here who listen to the Wild Side News. So therefore, a lot of things are happening, and people are really trying to figure out, how do we address this? We must make some changes. Society is moving. If we continue to move in the direction that we are, things aren't going to go so well for us. We face some dire elements in our future. And so people are doing things. But when you talk about climate, you're talking about some very, very complex systems, and so the solutions are not simple. In many respects, we're talking about global systems that have to be put into place, Kyoto being one of the examples of that. But as everyone knows, it's not necessarily universally accepted that such strategies are acceptable from an economic and other perspective. Nevertheless, people are doing things to create models, create systems, and to implement strategies to try to deal with this. And now joining us from Portland, Oregon, wonderful Portland, I love the city, I live there myself, is Mike Burnett. He's the executive director of the Climate Trust. That sounds interesting, Climate Trust. Mike, first of all, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to participate.
Climate Trust, you're a nonprofit. It's at www.climatetrust.org, just for people's information, and there are links on the show page today. How did the Climate Trust come to be?
Well, the Climate Trust was formed in 1997, so we're 10 years old, and we were formed in the wake of some legislation, very innovative legislation passed by the legislature in the state of Oregon, which required that the new power plants built in the state had to offset part of their emissions in order to get a site permit. And so a mechanism was set up where those companies who were building the new power plants could pay into the nonprofit, which is us, the Climate Trust, on a fee per ton emitted basis. And then we take the money, the Climate Trust takes the money, and then puts this into high-quality greenhouse gas reduction projects, which are also called offsets.
As we talk to different people around the country about various strategies, this sounds as if it is actually at a fairly high level of sophistication. That is to say that legislation has been put into place, mechanisms to focus on the power companies specifically, and standards and means of evaluating and putting a price, a literal dollar value on these emissions has been determined. It sounds as if that's fairly advanced.
Well, yes, very advanced and very innovative and unique. Oregon was the first state in the United States and maybe the first governmental entity anywhere to actually put in a regulation of greenhouse gases which required emissions reductions. And we've been operating under that for the last decade. And at the Climate Trust, we have now done offset work for four major power plants that have been built in the state, and have put 17 carbon dioxide offset projects, reduction projects, onto the landscape, and these will offset about 3 million tons of carbon dioxide over the life of those projects.
That's very progressive. So you've actually created a model, and people can look to Oregon and as well the Climate Trust to see how this operates. It's a very difficult subject for a lot of people to grasp, and that's why I think it's really important to talk with you, because you're actually doing it. I think one of the things that people get confused about is who, for example, the Climate Trust, it is literally a trust, and you must have a unique relationship with the state and the entities involved to administer these funds and this program. How does that happen? How is it that you're in that position?
Well, the mechanics of this are as follows. In order to get the site permit, the company must mitigate a certain percentage of the future stream of greenhouse gas emissions that would occur once the plant gets built. And then there's a calculation made as to how many tons they are in excess of a standard Oregon is set. And then that number of tons is converted through a fee per ton approach to a dollar payment that then comes to the Climate Trust. Then we go out and acquire the offsets. We invest in high-quality projects that meet very high standards. And then we own the kind of the benefit stream, the emissions reductions from the projects that we have invested in. And the state then counts that, I guess, against the permitting that is allowed for that power plant.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is challenging for people to comprehend, for example, some of the projects that climatetrust.org is working in are not in Oregon. And I think some people go, wait a second, how in the world can there be an offset, for example, in Minnesota or some other place? How can that work? It's a larger picture, isn't it?
Well, yes. Most air pollutants are local or regional, and they don't travel far. And so, you know, when we address with them in an excess of certain most other pollutants, we're concerned and try to control at the local level. But with global warming, the first word is global, the carbon dioxide is kind of spreads around the world within 4 days, and an emission reduction here in Oregon versus in Florida versus in Africa or China all have the same benefit as regards the climate. You know, the ton removed from the atmosphere anywhere has essentially the same effect.
And I think that's the really important message I want to have people first of all understand, is that these are models and strategies that are leading to a more globalized response, a much larger response. And you have to start somewhere so that they understand that, okay, it's not as if this is necessarily going to clean up the air right in Portland, for example, if there were a power plant in that area, but it is leading to a global resolution of this problem. And I think it's important for people to understand that that's kind of what we're looking at here.
Well, yes, certainly. And I guess the one way to look at offsets is the challenge of meeting climate change is a big challenge. It's because everything we do in our industrial economy uses fossil fuels, and there's other gases that we're emitting as well. And so, you know, it's going to take a major investment to kind of turn over our economy to a much lower carbon economy. And the benefit that offsets give to society is that they are a mechanism for allowing that transition to occur at the lowest total cost to society. And that's really important, because then we end up with more money left over to do everything else that we want to do in society, like eat and have shelter and clothing and you know, health care and recreation and all those things that are very important too, with security. So offsets are usually included in the regulatory systems that are emerging around the world and are in place in really much of the rest of the world other than the United States, that is called emissions trading. The idea is to have the regulatory bodies set a cap on the total amount of emissions and kind of allocate that cap among the various companies, and then they have to meet that cap, and they can do that by reducing the emissions from their own facilities that they own. Or they can invest in greenhouse gas reduction projects, carbon offset projects, and will do so to the extent that it's in a lower cost. So it's a way really to address climate change at the lowest cost to society, and that leaves us more money for everything else.
Obviously, that was the Kyoto model that so many nations around the world signed on to, and it will work best when everybody agrees to that, because then we can literally start to put a cap on the entire world's production of CO2 and start to lower those caps through time and therefore lower the gas house emissions. It's a long-term process here. The Climate Trust ends up getting a sizable, it's money is what it is, and I'm gonna try to find out if this is considered investment. The money that you have, you then reinvest. You take that and invest it in different projects, and one of the criteria for your investment, that the money that you invest is critical to their happening, that if it weren't for your participation, these projects perhaps may not happen. Talk about some of the ways in which that's manifested for you in your various projects.
It's very important that offset projects meet what is called, in our jargon, an additionality criteria, or it must be in addition to business as usual. And if you think about this, you know, if you have a regulatory system and you go to a factory and that's emitting, or a power plant that's emitting, and you say you have to reduce by 20% from your own smokestack, it's pretty easy to measure that and determine that and make sure that they have complied. And so then if you say, okay, you can do that, or you can do an offset project, then it's really important that the outcome for the atmosphere is essentially the same as if the emitter had done the work in his own facility. So he can either invest in his own facility, or he can invest in an offset project. And so when we look at offset projects, we're looking for projects that haven't occurred yet, and for which our money, a critical part of the funding package that makes the project happen. Also, our projects are subject to rigorous monitoring, third-party monitoring and verification of the reduction. So all of this is designed to ensure that the tons are real, that the emissions reductions are real, and that they're essentially equivalent to that which would occur if the facility had invested in its own, you know, internal reduction.
You know, oftentimes when people in college, for example, if you take economics or business courses or law courses, they'll start talking about Company A and Company B. And let's do this. Let's talk about Acme Power Company, which is a coal-burning facility. It's an old plant, and they're exceeding the emissions that people would like. They're not exactly a clean plant. And so under the Oregon regulations, they're required to offset. That's Acme Power Plant. Now, let's also talk about Greenco, which is a clean company someplace else. It's a company that you decide you're going to help. Let's say it's a solar power field. Acme Power Company has to cough up some money. That goes into the Climate Trust. On their books, how does that show up? No company ever gives away money without having to account for it, number one, and they have to call it something. How does that company on their books put down that money? And also, what are we talking about in terms of what a company has to literally transfer?
Well, currently, a typical new gas power plant built in Oregon would bring to us about $5 million, a little more, a little less, depends on the exact size and how efficient the plant is. And they typically deal with that, since this is in Oregon, the regulation is associated with new construction. That $5 million cost is essentially an adder at the time of financing. So they'll go out and borrow that money from the bank, and then they will just recover that over time in the cost that they charge for power.
It's a cost of doing business.
Yeah, it's a cost of doing business. Now, we do have, so we've talked largely about our Oregon regulatory program, and we have another program which might be of interest to your listeners. And that has to do with providing the same type of services, providing offsets to others than those who are regulated by Oregon. And so we call this our Greenhouse Gas Offset Partnership Program.
Mm-hmm.
And it has several elements. One is a large emitter program. So that's for power plants and fossil fuel companies and people who have really big greenhouse gas problems and are looking for kind of large-scale solutions. And those might be thought of like almost wholesale buyers in a way. And so we work with them. We've got, we just hit the streets last week with a 10 million ton request for offset proposals. This is the largest such activity, in the United States to date. So we're very proud and excited to be working with a handful of companies that are all electric power companies in that regard.
Could I ask you a question, too? Is it possible to say that 10 million tons, how that translates to megawatts? Because that's typically how we measure. What size facility would that kind of equate to?
If
it's possible to talk that way.
Well, a real rough number is that a typical coal plant emits a ton per megawatt hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a typical coal plant might be 500 megawatts. So, when it's running flat out, it's putting out 500 tons an hour. And so you can kind of start doing some calculations.
Right. There. That's very useful.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're dealing with it as a cost. And then the other side is then we go out and we run these solicitations. We say we have money to spend on offsets. Here are our criteria. These are high standards. Here's how you meet them. Submit proposals to us, and then we go through a rigorous review process, and it's kind of a multi-phase process. But out the end comes kind of the winners of the process. So if we have $5 million to spend on offsets, then we go out and we find $5 million worth of projects. Typical project might be $1 million project, maybe a $2 million project. And the types of things we've invested in is just a wide variety. One of the things we try to do is to have a diversified portfolio as far as technology and also as far as location to a certain extent and types of offset providers, organizations that are receiving money from us. So we put money into a wide variety of things such as renewable energy, done wind power, a couple of wind power projects. We've done building energy efficiency, new green buildings, and multifamily weatherization, which is low income. We put money into cogeneration projects where waste heat is used to power electricity. So, you know, that's a good thing for us to be doing. We've put money into district heating efficiency upgrades on city district heating systems, put money into transportation efficiency projects, which is something fairly unique to the Climate Trust in the offset market, is we've kind of tried to go into transportation, which is considered to be a difficult sector. So we put money into some truck stop electrification technology, into some traffic signal optimization. We've done stuff with concrete. We've done stuff with forests that can help capture carbon out of the atmosphere as well. So it's just a real wide variety and very interesting, you know, types of things that we get to spend our money on.
Very interesting. One of the questions that I would have is, you take serious amounts of money and you put them into different projects. What is your relationship to that project? In other words, do you become an investor? Are you required to have a return on your investment? Are you a co-owner or a part owner of that company? What's your relationship with those projects?
We're a buyer of the emissions benefit, the emissions reduction. So we don't take an equity position in a company or in a project, but we have a contract, and many of the people who have received money from us, because this is a fairly new and emerging market, and we're kind of a pioneer, they haven't ever done this before, and often they think of it, oh, this is a grant, you're giving me money for doing something good, and we have to say, no, we're actually really, this is a contract, and we're buying these emissions reductions from you. Since we're buying them and we go through this whole monitoring and verification procedure, if they don't show up over time, then we have to have, you know, kind of ways to make sure we're kept whole that are built into our contract.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I can see where you'd have to say, now listen, you just sold your greenhouse gas emission credits. You can't just keep selling them wantonly to anybody.
Oh, and that's a big part of the contract.
Exactly right.
And
so
you know, as we start registering and regulating greenhouse gases, they have sold that benefit to us, and so then, you know, they have to kind of act as if they haven't had that reduction from one point of view.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting concept. Very, very, very interesting. Now you're doing this on a fairly large scale, and you're really creating models for success. You also encourage participation by people, human beings out here, communities and small businesses and others. Talk a bit about that. How do you like to see their relationship?
We got started doing big deals for big companies, and that was a great way to get started. But not long after we got started, we were approached both by businesses and individuals and saying, well, the stuff you're doing is just great. You know, can't you put together mechanisms so that we can provide incremental funding to you all to then make more happen of what you all are doing, and so we set up our partnership program, which I mentioned before, and a couple elements of our partnership program are really focused much more towards smaller purchasers. We have a separate website that is carboncounter.org. Again, that's carboncounter.org, and this is a website that's a calculator, so you go in there and basically you kind of give it some vital statistics on your lifestyle as far as your home and car and air travel. And then it calculates how many tons, depending on how big your house is or how many square feet or what your electric bill is. We've got different things set up in there. And as well, it allows you to put in your airplane flights and all that. Airplane flights turn out to be a pretty big part of the average person's footprint. And then at the end, it tells you how many tons of carbon dioxide you're emitting, which for a typical family in America is like maybe 20 tons of carbon dioxide. And then it allows you, if you so choose, to use a credit card to offset part or all of that. You know, the cost for an offset is about $12 a ton right now on that website. And so a typical family could offset their emissions entirely for about $250 a year, which is within the realm of giving that people often give to nonprofits and environmental organizations.
Is that considered a tax-deductible contribution?
Yes, it's a tax-deductible contribution because we are a nonprofit, and you know, it's much like if you gave money to the Nature Conservancy. The Nature Conservancy would go out and buy an acre of land.
Mm-hmm.
We go out and buy a ton of carbon.
Yep.
So there's a kind of arm's length distance. And then we also have a program that we call Donate to Offset that's more focused on companies, you know, smaller companies or you know, the travel sections of bigger companies that might want to offset their travel budget for the year. And so, you know, we have a way where they donate money to us. All of this money, we're very sophisticated in our accounting. All this money goes into restricted trust funds, and then we spend the money, you know, at certain times through the year to add funding out to some of our offset projects, you know, so that, you know, the money goes to work fairly soon after we receive it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot to what you're doing, and I really commend you for stepping so boldly forward and making this happen. There's a lot to be learned, and quite honestly, people certainly can visit your website at www.climatetrust.org. Mike Burnett, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News and encourage people to contact you.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to be a member of the Wild Side for half an hour here today.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Hopefully, this all makes a lot more sense to you, as it does to me, after hearing our guests. This is Sidney Wildsmith, wishing you all a great week ahead. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, here on the Wild Side News.